Imagine waking up one morning to discover that a burglar broke into your home, stole your valuables, and then sent you the bill for the damage they caused. Sounds absurd? This is precisely what happened on a global scale after the 2008 financial crisis. What began as a massive private banking failure was cunningly reframed as a crisis of government spending, with devastating consequences for millions of ordinary citizens. Before 2008, few worried about national debts. Italy maintained debt at 105% of GDP in 2002 with little concern. Yet the same figure in 2009 suddenly triggered alarm bells. The difference? Governments had absorbed between $3 and $13 trillion in banking system bailouts. This crisis originated not in government profligacy, but in the shadow banking system, particularly the repo market, where financial institutions borrowed using increasingly questionable collateral. When housing prices declined in 2006, mortgage securities lost value, creating a collateral crisis. Banks, leveraged at ratios of 30 to 1 or higher, couldn't withstand even small devaluations. The financial sector had convinced itself that sophisticated risk models eliminated the possibility of systemic failure, essentially playing Russian roulette, growing more confident with each successful click until catastrophe struck. How did a banking crisis transform into a sovereign debt crisis requiring government austerity? When governments intervened to prevent collapse, they transferred massive private debt to public balance sheets, increasing state debt by 40-50% on average. Only 12% came from stimulus spending, while bailout costs and lost tax revenues accounted for the rest. Among the European pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, Spain, only Greece was truly profligate. Ireland and Spain had been model fiscal citizens with lower debt-to-GDP ratios than Germany. Their problems stemmed from property bubbles and banking failures, not government spending. The narrative shifted dramatically. The banking crisis vanished from discourse, replaced by concerns over government debt. This represents what Mark Blyth calls the greatest bait and switch in modern history. A banking crisis repackaged as a sovereign debt crisis, forcing citizens to pay for financial elites' mistakes through public service cuts. Austerity's resilience, despite repeated failures, stems from liberal economic philosophy. John Locke naturalized inequality and legitimized private ownership, creating what Blyth calls the liberal dilemma. The state is necessary but unwanted, especially regarding taxation. David Hume positioned merchants at the center of economic life, establishing enduring critiques of public debt as diverting capital from industry and creating dependence on foreign creditors. Adam Smith recast debt as a morality play, where saving is virtue and spending is vice, a framing still evident in how Northern European savers view profligate Southern Europeans. This moralization obscures a basic reality. Borrowers require lenders, savers require spenders. When everyone tries to save simultaneously, the economy contracts, Keynes's paradox of thrift. Yet austerity's appeal as moral rectitude continues to override evidence of its harmful effects, particularly during downturns when government spending is most needed. History provides little evidence that austerity works. During the interwar period, 1919 to 1939, countries implementing it suffered severely. America's liquidationist approach after the Wall Street crash deepened the depression, with unemployment reaching 23% when Hoover raised taxes in 1931. Roosevelt's reflation reduced it to 17%, but a premature return to austerity in 1937 triggered another recession. Britain's restoration of pre-war parity immediately created a million unemployed and a prolonged slump. Despite sacrificing the domestic economy for sterling's value, Britain's debt increased rather than decreased. In Germany, Chancellor Brüning's severe budget cuts in 1930 created political space for the National Socialists. In Japan, deflation to maintain gold standard parity led military officers to assassinate financial elites, including the Prime Minister. Austerity didn't just fail economically, it helped destroy the world order. That's the definition of a very dangerous idea. Despite austerity's poor historical record, it was revived in the 1980s through the concept of expansionary fiscal contractions. Economists like Alberto Alesina claimed cutting government spending could stimulate growth during downturns, citing Ireland's late 1980s adjustment as evidence. Subsequent research has thoroughly dismantled these claims. When the IMF re-examined the data with more sophisticated methods, they found fiscal contractions reliably reduced GDP by about 0.5% within 2 years and increased unemployment by 0.3 percentage points, with worse outcomes at near-zero interest rates. Of Alesina's 26 supposedly expansionary austerity episodes, virtually none delivered benefits during economic slumps. Countries that successfully consolidated were already growing before adjustment. These findings proved significant during the European sovereign debt crisis of 2010-2012, when many countries implemented austerity measures based on this discredited research, resulting in deeper recessions and higher unemployment that practically refuted the expansionary austerity hypothesis. While the European Union has been an extraordinary political success, maintaining peace and transforming dictatorships into democracies, its monetary project has been disastrous for most members except Germany. Despite economists' warnings that the Eurozone wasn't an optimal currency area, the euro launched anyway, producing economic divergence while bond yields mysteriously converged to near German levels. This convergence flooded periphery states with cheap money, making them vulnerable to capital flight. Periphery consumers used this cash to buy German products, creating massive current account imbalances. European banks essentially executed a massive moral hazard trade, swapping low-yield German debt for higher-yielding periphery debt with heavy leverage, either believing the ECB had eliminated risk or knowing they'd be bailed out. These banks grew to dwarf their sovereign guarantors. While the top six U.S. banks' assets equaled 61% of U.S. GDP in 2008, European banks reached alarming proportions. France's top three banks totaled 316% of French GDP, and Deutsche Bank alone represented 80% of German GDP at 40-to-1 leverage. When crisis hit, these too-big-to-bail banks left countries trapped between euro membership and growth-killing austerity measures. Iceland and Ireland showcase contrasting approaches to banking crises. Ireland guaranteed its major banks while implementing severe austerity, cutting public wages by 15%, reducing welfare, and raising taxes as unemployment reached 15%. This triggered emigration of over 300,000 people, mostly young professionals. Iceland instead allowed its largest banks to fail, prosecuted bankers, imposed capital controls, protected domestic depositors while letting foreign creditors absorb losses, and devalued its currency. Iceland recovered quickly, with unemployment falling to 7% by 2011, while Ireland remained at 15%. Austerity's fundamental flaw is its unequal distribution of pain. Cuts to state spending disproportionately impact services used by middle and lower-income populations. In the United States, inequality has reached extreme levels. The top 1% captures 23.8% of national income, while the richest 400 Americans possess more wealth than the bottom 150 million combined. Expecting those at the bottom to pay for problems created by financial speculation at the top fails both mathematically and morally. Until we recognize how austerity serves as political cover for upward redistribution, we remain trapped in self-defeating policies that threaten economies and democracies. When someone claims we've all been living beyond our means, we should ask, who exactly is this we? And whose means are truly being protected?